content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mary Grace Payden for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Religion News Service. Our first article was published on October 27 and written by Catherine Post, entitled, 5 Years After Massacre, Tree of Life Rabbi Inspires a Psalm for Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh. In the days after October 27, 2018, when an anti-Semitic gunman stormed the Tree of Life Synagogue at the heart of Pittsburgh's Jewish community, Rabbi Jeffrey Myers was unable to pray. Myers, the rabbi and cantor for Tree of Life, had survived the worst anti-Semitic attack in U.S. history by hiding in a small second-floor bathroom near a choir loft. By the time it was over, the shooter had taken 11 lives from 3 congregations meeting at the synagogue for Shabbat services that day. Experiencing anguish and at a loss for words, Myers turned to the Book of Psalms, knowing the full range of human emotions that the Psalms represent during King David's life. Myers told Religion News Service, he started at Psalm 1 and began reading through each of them, looking for inspiration. Then he landed on Psalm 121. I lift my eyes to the hills. Where will my help come? My help comes from God, maker of heavens and earth, he read. There it was, said Myers. It said it in such simplicity. In the words of the psalm, Myers found space for both sorrow and solace. He began to incorporate the psalm into his daily routine, making it the first thing he read after waking up. With these words, he could pray again. In August, after gunman Robert Bowers was sentenced to death by a unanimous jury for the deadly hate crimes, Myers spoke to reporters at a press conference at Pittsburgh's Jewish Community Center, saying that while many of those affected by the shooting had been stuck in neutral for 5 years, the end of the trial, he hoped, signaled a new season of healing. It added a layer of trauma to us, now remembering 5 years, which is traumatic enough. You add that additional piece, the pain, the fear in America that is so rampant, said Myers. It's made the anniversary even more impactful this year. Even amid the terror of the Hamas attacks and the mass shooting in Lewiston, Maine, Myers said Psalm 121 continues to resonate. It's the lighthouse in the fog, said Myers. Sometimes you wonder, where are the answers? That psalm just comes right through to me clearly and just gives me reassurance for the day. Now the psalm and its impact on Myers will be shared with an entirely new audience. This spring, Myers contacted Gerald Cohen, a Jewish composer and cantor at Sha'arei Tikva in Scarsdale, New York. Myers had learned that Violins of Hope, a group that organizes concerts featuring a collection of violins played by Jews during the Holocaust, would be coming to Pittsburgh. He immediately knew that the instruments with this legacy had to be involved in a composition commemorating the shooting. While the owners of these instruments were silenced, the violins were not, and they continue to testify of what happens when evil is unchecked, said Myers. And yet, out of them can be such beauty, despite what these violins witnessed. The Tree of Life congregation commissioned Cohen to compose a setting of Psalm 121 in memory of the 11 victims of the shooting. The piece will premiere with Myers as the soloist alongside the Pittsburgh Youth Chorus at an interfaith concert on November 8 at the University of Pittsburgh, featuring Violins of Hope. I hope I can hold it together when I sing, said Myers, who was rehearsing the piece with the Pittsburgh Youth Chorus for the first time on Monday. The piece, called A Psalm for Pittsburgh, is inspired by the comfort Myers found in the psalm in the wake of the tragedy. My focus was on his personal journey and the journey of anyone who is going through great suffering and mourning and sorrow, Cohen told RNS, knowing that meditating on this text is what allowed him to move forward. That certainly has colored in a powerful way my thoughts about the psalm. Sung in Hebrew, Cohen's piece begins tentatively with a wordless melody, eventually giving way to single words, then a dialogue with the youth chorus. From where will my help come? The soloist asks. My help is from Adonai, maker of the heavens and the earth, the youth chorus answers. This is such an atmospheric piece. It's very deep. It evokes all kinds of feelings, as it should, Sean Funk, artistic director of the Pittsburgh Youth Chorus, told RNS. The music provides a story in and of itself. Cohen said his composition is not about transcending grief, but about finding a way toward a glimmer of hope and returning to a love of the world, even in the midst of sorrow. And hope is what our world desperately needs, according to Myers. He said it's the support from people in Pittsburgh, the emails and letters of encouragement he receives daily from around the world, and music like this that continue to bring healing. Music, when it comes in the ears, it doesn't go to your brain, said Myers. It goes directly to your heart, and it can uplift you in ways that go far beyond words. Our next article was published on October 30, written by Mark Thiessen, and entitled Anchorage's Oldest Building, a Russian Orthodox Church, Gets New Life in Restoration Project. Iklutna, Alaska. The Russian Orthodox Church on the outskirts of Alaska's biggest city is packed with treasures for the Christian faithful. Religious icons gifted by Romanov czars, panels of oil paintings, and jewel-studded incense burners. But outside the hand-hewn log sanctuary, dozens of miniature Alaska Native spirit houses sit by aging gravesites, alongside Orthodox crosses poking from the cemetery grounds. The narrow church, with white-framed windows near Anchorage, is a vestige of Russia's nearly 150-year attempt to colonize Alaska and the indigenous people who lived there. But over time, St. Nicholas Church became an important touchstone for Alaska Natives as well. The church lies within the Alaska Native village of Iklutna, and many are buried there. Now, an extensive 3-year restoration project that began this month is bringing more attention to the tiny church that is a window into a complex and often forgotten chapter of Alaska's unique history. The Dena'ina Athabascan tribe supports the restoration, and some tribal members turned out on a recent October day to watch the removal of the bell tower and to reminisce. With the restoration of the church, we can now once again walk where our ancestors walked, pray where they prayed, said Charlene Shaganah, whose grandfather was the last traditional chief in Iklutna, and who recalls wandering through the church and among the spirit houses as a young child. With the rebirth of the old St. Nicholas Church, it will nourish our spirits and our souls. The project is paid for by a $350,000 grant from the National Park Service. Preservationists hope it will spur further work, not only to inventory the church's religious icons, but also the spirit houses, in partnership with the tribe. There's a long history of the Dena'ina and Iklutna, in particular, taking care of the church and trying to maintain it, said Aaron Leggett, president and chairman of the Native Village of Iklutna's Tribal Council. There aren't that many Russian Orthodox followers anymore, but it's part of our heritage, and we do want to see it preserved. The presence of the Russian Orthodox Church is perhaps the most visible legacy of Russia's Alaska Odyssey, which began nearly 3 centuries ago when Peter the Great sent Danish mariner Vitus Bering to claim new territory east of Russia in 1725. Bering made landfall in Alaska in 1741, And soon, Russian trappers flooded the area for its sea otter pelts and clashed with Aleuts who lived there. Russian settlements sprang up across Alaska, first in Unalaska in 1772, and then further north and east as the fur trading industry took hold. Russia sold Alaska to the United States for $7.2 million in 1867, and Alaska became a U.S. state in 1959. The Russian Orthodox Church was established in Alaska on Kodiak Island in 1794, and missionaries spread the faith, baptizing an estimated 18,000 Alaska natives. Today, up to 50,000 Alaskans practice the Orthodox faith. Many Alaska geographic places still bear Russian names. Their language and traditions merged with indigenous tribes over the decades, and many Alaska natives have Russian surnames after intermarriage. Experts estimate about 80 historic Orthodox churches exist across Alaska, but weather and time are taking a toll, making restoration efforts even more critical. There are 33 churches on the National Register of Historic Places, and about a third of them need urgent restoration, said Russian Orthodox Sacred Sites in Alaska, which is dedicated to preserving the churches in the state. Better preserved churches, some with iconic onion domes atop them, can be found in bigger cities, including Anchorage, Unalaska, Kenai, and Sitka. Unique among them is the old Iklutna Church, where graves incorporate religious conventions like Orthodox crosses, which have three cross beams with the lowest slanted, with the Dinaya Athabascan tradition of building spirit homes above graves where the deceased person's spirit can reside. Some are simple, but others have brightly painted roofs, gables, and even chimneys. Vice President Richard Nixon and his family visited the cemetery and its spirit houses in 1958. The Russians did not try to Russify the natives, said the Reverend Deacon Thomas Rivas, the Episcopal secretary to the Alaska Orthodox Bishop. They're very much the inheritors of the faith, and they're the inheritors of the land, even though it was given to the church in stewardship. A federal document says the compact church was built in 1870, but acknowledges it could be older because the style is less formal than other Russian Orthodox churches in Alaska from the late 19th century. Legate of the Iklutna's Tribal Council said for hundreds of years, indigenous people have moved back and forth across a body of water known as the Kinnick Arm, an offshoot of Cook Inlet. In the late 19th century, the entire village moved to its current location about 25 miles northeast of downtown Anchorage, because the other side of the inlet became overrun with trappers and gold miners. With the town came St. Nicholas Church. My grandfather probably played a part in moving this building, using a boat going across the inlet, said Gina Andala, 79, who came to the bell tower removal ceremony and remembers attending the church for funerals and on holidays. Those attending the church sang hymns in Russian, she said. The priest conducted the service in Russian, which very few understood. The church's role in daily village life has diminished over the years, and attendance is low, Rivas said. The church has no full-time pastor, but is a vibrant tourist destination. A new church in 1962 replaced the historic sanctuary, which is now closed for the restoration work. Stored inside are religious artifacts and icons and religious paintings, done usually on wood, depicting famous persons and events from the Bible. The Russian Imperial Mission Society, which was founded by the Romanov Tsars to support Orthodox mission work in Siberia and Alaska, gave the church many of the artifacts still kept there, Rivas said. The restoration project is intended to bring the building back to its most important period of significance, around the 1920s, historic architect Joby Bernier said. It still is important that it is a tourist site and tourist destination and an informative site, he said. However, its primary function is sacred, and that's what's important to all of us, even those of us who are not Russian Orthodox. Our next article was published on November the 1st, written by Adele M. Banks, and is entitled Middle Collegiate Church Nears Time for Demolition of Its Historic Facade. Middle Collegiate Church, the New York City congregation whose historic building suffered a devastating fire nearly 3 years ago, has received permission to remove the heavily damaged remnant of its 19th century neo-Gothic facade. The Reverend Jackie Lewis, who leads the multi-ethnic church in Manhattan's East Village, said the pending work is a mixture of good news and renewed grief about the loss of the building that was completed in 1892. All of us are going to have a revisitation of our sorrow, she said, on October the 30th. The facade looks like it survived, but it really didn't. There will be a new grief, I think, about that. The city's Landmarks Preservation Commission found that the overall loss of historic fabric due to the fire, structural issues, damaged masonry and woodwork, and the partial deconstruction required to make the site safe will result in a building that no longer retains its own integrity as a building that contributes to the East Village, Lower East Side Historic District. After endorsing a certificate of appropriateness in January, the commission issued a related permit on September 19 that was contingent on other city approvals. The city's Department of Buildings issued a permit to the general contractor for the project for the use of heavy machinery to perform the demolition work, said Andrew Rudansky, the department's press secretary. Firefighters worked to extinguish a fire that erupted from the building next to Middle Collegiate Church on December 5, 2020 in New York. The historic 19th century church in Lower Manhattan was gutted by a massive fire that sent flames shooting through the roof. Lewis said she hoped the demolition could begin in early November and estimated it could last a few months. Some preservationist groups had expressed concerns about the removal of the facade. Lower East Side Preservation Initiative, a local not-for-profit group, had said the demolition would hurt the special character of this very important historic district. Andrew Berman, executive director of Village Preservation, told the Village Sun, an online publication, in January that the commission's decision to grant the church's request may open the door to more demolitions and much less desirable uses than a new home for a church at this location and other landmark sites. Lewis responded at the time that the church determined to rebuild a worship building on the same site. Negotiations with city officials took months longer than expected, she said this week. Part of the plan agreed to with the city includes efforts to save some of the limestone and ironwork of the building to use in the new sanctuary that is the eventual focus of a fundraising campaign. We tried to save a couple of ornamental pieces that we hope we can repurpose in the new building, Lewis said. With the demolition approved, Middle Church, which is dually aligned with the Reformed Church in America and the United Church of Christ, has two more phases of planning. Lewis said she hopes the church's five-story townhouse next door, which was damaged by water sprayed at the church by firefighters, can be renovated to house a temporary worship service by December 2024. Since the fire, Middle Collegiate's 120 to 170 in-person worshipers have been meeting at East End Temple, a Reform synagogue 10 blocks away. The townhouse property, Lewis said, would be incorporated into the larger footprint of a neighborhood assembly space that we would worship in on Sunday, but that the community can use for concerts or town hall gatherings. In a third phase, Lewis added, the church would seek to build a permanent sanctuary in partnership with another organization that is interested in also using the site for affordable housing or some other social service-oriented mission. The Landmarks Commission noted in its permit that it will work with the church on the planned redesign of a new building. Lewis estimates that it will cost $35 million to $40 million to complete all three stages. She said $6 million of a $15 million fundraising campaign has already been collected. Middle Church is one of four collegiate churches of New York that sprung from a 17th century Reformed church congregation when New York was still New Amsterdam, and are considered the oldest continuously practicing Protestant congregations in the Americas. Its companion churches are the Marble Collegiate Church, where Norman Vincent Peale was pastor, the West End Church, and the Fort Washington Church. Lewis expects the congregation will mark the demolition with a time of prayer and song before it occurs. Our congregation will be making a journey to the site on December 4, she added, as we commemorate the third anniversary of the fire that destroyed our sacred space. Our last piece was published on October 20 and written by Bob Smetana. In tough times, churches can't afford to go it alone, new book advises. America's congregations are in trouble these days. They're facing polarization, a worldwide pandemic, shrinking memberships, a changing culture, and uncertain futures. Like most of us, they could use a few friends to face their troubles with and figure out together how best to respond, says Samford University sociologist Jennifer McClure Haraway. Congregations are experiencing a lot of change and opportunities and challenges, she said. We navigate those more effectively when we work together. When we feel like we're alone, we tend not to navigate them as well. In her new book, No Congregation is an Island, Haraway hopes to remind churches and other houses of worship of the benefits of working together. The book is based on a survey of more than 400 congregations in and around Birmingham, Alabama, about how they partner with other congregations. After finishing her initial studies in 2017 and 18, Haraway wrote a series of academic papers about her findings. But, she said, no one aside from her fellow scholars read the studies. Those articles are very technical, and I can't hand them to any local minister, even though they have practical applications, she said. That led to turning her findings into a short and helpful book that would be accessible to congregational leaders. Based on her initial findings, along with follow-up interviews and stories, the book looks at how congregations work together with folks from their own tradition, as well as those from other groups, and gives tips on how to better collaborate. One of her tips, go to denominational meetings, which still matter even during a time when those denominations are in decline, but for friendship, not necessarily the programs or debates. One of the most important things these events can and should nurture are the relationships between ministers and leaders, she writes. While working in their own tradition is simpler, having shared theology and common practices, ministers shouldn't limit themselves to only cooperating with folks from the same denomination, she says. Otherwise, they might miss out on the insights that come from people who have a different point of view. Working across traditions can be complicated, she writes, especially if groups have different views on core doctrines. Still, as the leader of one denominational church put it, There's a benefit in breaking free of groupthink. Sometimes I just want to talk with my mom's Methodist pastor and see what they're talking about, because I think they're probably having a different conversation, Haraway recalls him saying. That would be helpful for me. The 438 congregations in the study include houses of worship from 8 counties, all in the middle part of Alabama. Most are Christian, given Alabama's place in the Bible Belt, but the study did include mosques and synagogues. The congregations ranged from churches with a handful of members to megachurches. Despite their differences, the congregations in the study often had a great deal in common. One chapter of the book compares the Churches of Christ, a group that uses no instruments in worship, with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. The two groups are different from the outside. The Churches of Christ are fiercely independent and skeptical of any hierarchical structures, while the Latter-day Saints have a highly organized and interdependent structure with clear leaders at the top. Both have their own distinct theology. Yet both are so-called restorationist movements, founded by people trying to capture something essential about Christianity they believe was lost. Both have a clear sense of their mission and an identity tied to that mission. That makes them very tight-knit, Haraway said. One of the last chapters of the book deals with groups that cooperate across racial lines. Almost half the groups Haraway studied had no ties to congregations that had a different racial makeup. That did not surprise her, given the country's continuing racial divides, and the way churches often closely associate with other congregations from their own denominations, and those denominations are divided racially. Pastors from different, predominantly white groups are much more likely to have full-time roles, while many Black and Hispanic pastors are bivocational, having a day job alongside their ministry. That can make difficult even something as simple as setting aside a time for pastors from different backgrounds to meet. The book offers no easy solutions, but does offer some advice for congregations that have been able to work together in diverse settings. To build healthy partnerships across race, know that it takes time to develop trust, Haraway advises. Be willing and patient to do what it takes. We have run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mary Grace Payton, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.